Hello and welcome to the Sweep Podcast with me, Mitchell Willis, and him, Michael Hall.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm all right, thank you. Yeah, I'm pretty much at the limit when it comes to football. We're nearing the end, aren't we, of seems like the longest season ever. The World Cup kind of rolled straight into the Premier League. The Premier League then rolled straight into the Nations League, and now we've got the Women's World Cup, and football's never ended at the moment.
Yeah, I'm done with the game. I've had enough. Cricket's on as well, which is always a bonus.
Big cricket fans.
We were going to do the Keeper podcast.
Good.
Wicket Keeper podcast.
You spoiled it a bit with that, yeah. But yeah.
I'm happy that it's the end of the season. But there's been a little bit going on as well. We've had a bit of a break. It's all been a bit weird, hasn't it? It's been a bit disjointed.
Absolutely. But the reason that we thought it was a good idea to round the season up is because, like you say, quite a lot's actually happened since we last got together. There have been trophies handed out left, right and centre. One of those going to a club who's, I suppose, got quite a big fan in this room. And a couple of others going to clubs that I suppose you probably aren't too surprised that they won them. So lots to sum up. And I think that we should probably start in Madrid.
Yeah, let's start in Madrid, because that was the pinnacle of the club season, really. The Champions League final. Liverpool won it. They beat Spurs 2-0. And I think they deserve to win a competition this year, Liverpool. They have been very impressive throughout the season. They were unlucky not to win the Premier League. It was just pure coincidence that we just have probably the best Premier League team we've ever seen in front of them. But it was an odd game, wasn't it? I think they were possibly second best on the night.
I think so. I think the early goal was obviously a bit of a killer for Tottenham, but you'd argue that Liverpool didn't create a huge amount other than that. And it was a game that promised a huge amount and actually delivered very little. I think that we were all, as a nation, really looking forward to seeing two of the best teams in the country going head to head for a European competition, and we'd obviously had the enjoyment of the semi-finals, and I think that the final just didn't really live up to those, did it? It was almost like a lot of energy had been sapped from those players.
Would you call it drab? A drab affair?
It was a drab affair, and people have talked a lot about the fact that it was down to the fact that these players have had 3 weeks off. I'm not completely convinced with that, because you would argue that that would actually give them more energy and you would expect maybe a little bit more from them. And in terms of match practice, Liverpool had a friendly before the game, and Tottenham tried to do something behind closed doors, and not too much has come out about that. But I just wonder whether they need to look at the schedule and think about whether 3 weeks is too big a gap, or whether it's something that they need to amend for next year. Obviously, the Nations League will have possibly had a bit of an impact on that, and you could argue that that was positioned at a bad time, because actually then England go into that without a lot of the players who played in this final. So it was a bit of a weird occasion for me. It was a bit of a weird game, and it kind of felt like a non-event for any neutral watching, and also possibly some of the fans that were out there. I'm sure Liverpool fans won't care one jot, but I think that it could have been a lot better.
You mentioned that early goal. Penalty for you?
Not at all. No, I think if the ball comes off your chest first and then hits your arm, then it shouldn't be a penalty. And we kind of thought that all of these decisions with VAR would be cleared up, because you would have experts looking from different angles. And the fact they've still got that wrong shows that, as far as I'm concerned, VAR should only be there for black and white decisions.
I think there's more on VAR later. Divock Origi got the second goal. He seems to be cropping up in these big games. Almost wasn't at the club at the start of the season. A really odd one, isn't he? He's just where did he come from? He scored in that Everton game, yep, which was just a ridiculous goal in the first place from Pickford's mistake.
Yeah.
You then basically didn't see him for the rest of the season. Cropped up in the semi-final, and then obviously comes up not necessarily the winner in this, but the one that kind of saw them home comfortably.
I think when you look at the front three that Liverpool have had for the majority of the season, the obvious replacement was Shaqiri or Sturridge if any of those three got injured. So Origi's been on the fringes. Obviously, like you said, he was linked with a move to Huddersfield in the transfer window, which nearly came off. Spent the season on loan at Wolfsburg last year and didn't really pull up any trees. So it's a surprise to see the impact that he's had on these big games, but he strikes me as a character who, he doesn't seemed to get too overawed by the occasion, and you kind of saw that with the interview after this game and the way that he celebrated. It wasn't complete and utter outpouring of joy or relief or anything like that. It was just like, yeah, I've scored, and it's a Champions League final, and that's great. And I just wonder whether he's the sort of player who would thrive elsewhere. I think that he probably needs game time, but the likelihood is that Liverpool will hang on to him, because what a great substitute to have. But at the stage in his career, he's probably at a point where he needs to be playing week in, week out, and maybe at a club who are a little bit lower down the table. Someone like Palace, for example.
Yeah, no, I agree. And you mentioned celebrations there. He was laid back, to say the least. Not as laid back as some, but I think Jurgen Klopp was probably one of the drunkest men in Liverpool for probably a couple of days then.
Yeah, there was a video, wasn't there, that was doing the rounds of him pouring beer on Rian Brewster, who was celebrating while they're on the bus, and I think there was another clip flying around where he'd gone to sit at the back of the bus, and somebody had to say to him, look, you are in danger of toppling off a double-decker bus here, and he just didn't care. I think
he's
he'd had
absolute Uncle Knobhead.
Yeah, I think he'd had quite a lot of lager. The worst part for me was the interview that he did with Jan Arge Fjortoft after the game, and I don't know if you've seen this or not.
I don't think I have.
Okay, well, I'll tweet it out. It's basically him having a little sing-song at the end of it, and it's not his finest hour, let's put it that way. I think, as much as Liverpool probably, I was going to say deserved the win, as much as Liverpool deserved the trophy this season, I think I would have preferred to see Pochettino's reaction at the final whistle had they won, because I think he probably would have done it in a little bit more style than old Jurgen.
I mean, he'll be very frustrated. I think Spurs were unlucky on the night, and I think it was just a bit of an odd one, wasn't it? Because they had the opportunity to go and win that game, and I don't think they'll ever get an opportunity like that to go and win a Champions League final again, personally. I'm not sure he necessarily got his tactics right that night either. I understand why Harry Kane started, but I don't think that was the right decision. I think we've obviously seen that with England as well over the last few weeks, but we'll talk about that later. But I think you're playing against Liverpool, you have the opportunity to get in behind them, you can thread balls through, be a little bit sharper. You've got Lucas Moura, who's going to be on a massive high, from the end of the season, not even starting the game.
I think a lot of the tactical battle was kind of won and lost in Pochettino's decisions to try and nullify the fullbacks for Liverpool, and obviously that worked. But what that did mean was there wasn't as much space in behind those Liverpool fullbacks, because they weren't getting as forward as much as they have done over the season, and that's possibly what caused the game to be a little bit drab, as you mentioned earlier. I think that had both teams just gone for it hammer and tongs in the normal style that they would be used to playing, I think we probably would have seen more of a spectacle.
Yep.
But ultimately, from a Liverpool point of view, no one will care, because they've gone there, they've won their sixth European Cup, and it doesn't matter how you play, nobody remembers the result. And you look back at what happened in Istanbul, where they were 3-0 down at half time, and I think that's probably the only European Cup victory that people will actually remember what happened during the game, because of the fact that there was that epic comeback. And you look at the games in the past 5 or 6 years, I think you'd probably struggle to remember how those games went, and that's why it will mean so much to Liverpool fans to have that extra star on their badge, but they won't care one bit about the actual 90 minutes that we saw.
And where do both go from here? Liverpool looking to win the league next year, you'd have thought?
I think they have to. I think they're at a position now where they obviously were so close this season that it would be stupid for the off-pitch members of that organisation not to try and strengthen the squad even further. I still think that they're missing a couple of players. Yep. I think Joel Matip's been good towards the end of the season, but ultimately they need a centre-half who's going to go in alongside Van Dijk and be able to play week in, week out at that sort of level, and that's where De Ligt from Ajax might be a good signing for them.
Gomez is fit, though. He potentially gets the chance.
I think, again, the difficulty is you are banking on a player who's been injured for a lot of his career so far, and to go in with those two as your first choice centre-half pairing would be a little bit risky, because the chances are within 3 months you might be changing that up, and I think that's where Liverpool have struggled in the past. I don't think they're a million miles away. Obviously, they were so close last time round. The difficulty is going to be to replicate that, because sides will know how to play against them now, and we saw Tottenham go with quite a straightforward tactical decision in that game. But if other teams do similar things next season, then Liverpool will find it harder to score goals. So that's the difficulty. As we saw with Manchester City, teams try different things against them, and this will happen with Liverpool because teams will become more and more wary of playing against them. So I think that they've got a great opportunity of going on and winning the league, but the only way that they'll be able to do that is to keep that squad together and strengthen.
And Spurs, they potentially lose a player, some players this summer. Not necessarily sure how much money they've got to strengthen the squad. There's still slight doubts over the manager being there as well, I think, and it's a potential period of transition for them after such a positive season.
I would have thought that if Pochettino was going to go, he would have gone straight after that final. I don't think that there will be a change in manager there now because I just don't think it would give them enough time to do what they need to do. My expectation would be that they will spend money this summer because obviously they've gone quite a while now without spending any. So you'd imagine that Christian Eriksen will probably be moved on. There's been talks of Real Madrid trying to assemble a Galacticos team again, and obviously they've already started to do yep. that, and Eriksen will be another piece in that jigsaw. And from a Tottenham point of view, I don't think it would be the end of the world. I think that by having money to spend would probably benefit that side, and they are one-dimensional at times. You look at the amount of games that they ended up losing last season, and they were streaks ahead of teams around them in terms of where you consider they were 3 months previous. They were in with a really good chance of winning the league. They were close to Liverpool and City, and then towards the end of the season, everything just tailed off, and they started losing more and more games. So something needs to change there, but not a huge amount. And I think that Pochettino is definitely the right person to take them forward and make the changes that he needs to.
There was another European final, and I just about remember it. I've tried to kind of forget about it, but Jesus Christ, if we thought the Champions League final was drab. The first half of the Europa League final between Chelsea and Arsenal was one of the least enjoyable football experiences I've ever had.
The whole thing was crap. There's been a lot said about the fact that it was in Baku, the atmosphere, the lack of fans, the fact that 16,000 tickets were returned and no travel options and all that sort of stuff. And we could talk about that until blue in the face. But ultimately, I think we need to talk about the game because regardless of where it was played, the players are still on a level playing field, aren't they? And there's no real advantage to where it is. I think that the difficulty in this one was that tactically, both Emery and Sarri tried to do something very similar in the first half, and neither of them wanted to be too expressive in the way that they played football. They were quite happy to keep it tight, and it was kind of the complete opposite to the way both sides approached the semi-finals against Valencia and Eintracht Frankfurt.
Yep.
And then it was almost like at half-time they both went, do you know what, lads, let's just go for it in the second half. And I made the mistake of leaving the room for about 5 minutes. I think I missed three goals. so that just tells you the story of the second half. It was a bit like a basketball match at times. And obviously Chelsea got into the lead and were pegged back by a very good Alex Iwobi goal, but then showed their class towards the end. And I think it's probably a fitting way for Eden Hazard to finish his career at Chelsea, to go out with, I think it was his seventh major trophy since he's been there. And he scored a huge amount of goals, provided lots of assists, and will go down as one of the Premier League greats.
Yeah, I'll miss him for sure. He's definitely provides entertainment. I think that Chelsea side over the years have been, you know, fairly dull at times, and he's been the bright spark. You know, we've seen it this season that he's dragged them through games, and I think he shone in this final as well. I thought Olivier Giroud probably had one of his best games, or certainly the second half anyway.
I want to get your opinion on Olivier Giroud, because obviously Chelsea have got this transfer ban. There's Tammy Abraham, who will presumably go back there initially. Until whoever yep. the manager is gets the chance to run the rule over him. Would you be comfortable, if you're thinking from a Chelsea fan's point of view, as going with Giroud as your starting striker? Because he always seems to do quite well when he plays for Chelsea.
Yeah, I personally would. I'm a big fan of Giroud. I don't think he's... I think he knows what he offers, and you know what he offers as well. I don't think he is going to kind of change that. I don't think anyone wants to change that, but play around him. You know, he's the perfect front man to just be that focal point of playing around him, and unfortunately they've probably lost the best player to do that with Hazard. But I think he offers so much in the air. I mean, he scored 11 goals just in this competition, and I appreciate he didn't score many Premier League goals, but equally over half his appearances were probably off the bench as well. He's one of those players that probably does take a little bit of time to get into the game. Equally, you do have to change your tactics to play around him as well. If you're starting the game with somebody else who's completely different to him, unless the whole team changes what they're going to do, he's probably not going to be effective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair sort of understanding of his strengths and weaknesses. Somebody that was playing their last game and who's also played for both of these clubs was Petr Cech, who was arguably one of the best players on the pitch that night and still conceded an absolute hatful. So he goes out, obviously, not in the way that he would have wanted to, but also in strange circumstances because it looks like he's going back to Chelsea as a sporting director. I don't think anything's been agreed there, but the best goalkeeper in the Premier League era, or certainly up there?
Yeah, he's one of them. He's probably, he's certainly top five, probably top three. I think, you know, you could argue Schmeichel maybe up there as well, but I don't think the stats lie, that's for sure. I think he's kind of top of the stats, is he?
Yeah, most, I think clean he's had, sheets, that's so, right.
You know, they don't lie. He's a model professional as well. You know, he's kind of calm under pressure. You know, he's not one of those that will be screaming and shouting at defenders. A completely different mould to Schmeichel, but he's gone into both Chelsea and Arsenal and just been exemplary, really. You know, he's got a mistake in his locker, but I don't think I could tell you a single moment where he's made a mistake, though. There's nothing that really springs to mind, and I think on that basis he's certainly a Premier League legend. I think if you were putting two teams together of Premier League all-stars, it'd probably be in one of them.
Absolutely. I think we need to just touch on Maurizio Sarri before we move on, because he's had what some would describe as a bit of a roller coaster first season.
He looked weathered when he came in. He looks he looks like he's been rained on all year now.
Yeah, he does look like somebody who smokes 60 cigarettes a day, doesn't he? And I think you look at their season and they've finished in the Champions League places. They'll be there next season. They've obviously won the Europa League, so they've qualified twice for that competition.
Yep.
And they were very unlucky in a League Cup final, which could have gone a different way against a very good Manchester City side. And then there's people calling for his head, and it looks actually that he may well be on his way to Juventus. So what do you think of Sarri? Do you think that he just wasn't cut out for the Premier League, or do you think that he's just underappreciated by the fans that we've got over here?
I think he's massively underappreciated, to be honest. I think he came in to try and change the way that they played football. And I'm not sure that Chelsea are the right club to necessarily do that with. I think they're very stuck in their ways. That, you know, they've got a lot of players that have already seen managers off. And generally they see them off because they don't like what they're doing. And I think, you know, as soon as you go into that club, unless you can get them on side straight away, and this is the weird thing about it, they didn't really seem to take Sarri, and he looked like he was trying his hardest. But actually, when you looked at the end of this game, the celebrations, they looked to have very good relationships. There was a lot of smiles, there was a lot of handshakes and hugs, and I don't think that was necessarily for the cameras. I think they actually appreciate him as a person, possibly not as a manager as such. They possibly don't buy into what it is that he's trying to do, and I think that takes a little bit of time. And actually, I think were he to continue and the transfer ban stood, they would all know that realistically they have to all stick together. And I think that's possibly the issue, though. If they don't want to do that, then he is in a world of trouble. Whereas actually, I think if they all brought into it, they possibly would be successful as well.
Quick mention for another departing goalkeeper as well.
Go on.
Rob Green, who lifted the trophy for Chelsea and then retired quite quickly afterwards. I mean, I'll just say my piece on Rob Green. The only real thing from his career that I remember was that absolute howler against the USA in the World Cup. And he was a pretty good goalkeeper. He's obviously had quite a few clubs and played for England, so he's had a great career. And I'm just surprised from his point of view that he's not sticking around as a number three, because I don't really think it matters what age you get to. Surely you can just keep doing that job where you're unlikely to play many games.
Yeah, he's massively appreciated it as well, because I've seen a couple of interviews with him this year, and you know, he's talked about what he does do behind the scenes. He still trains every day, but he works with some of the younger players, and I think you almost become a member of the coaching staff to a certain extent if you're experienced like that. I think Stuart Taylor's kind of, and Richard Wright have gone on to do similar things as well.
Yeah.
But, I mean, for Rob Green, he's clearly a character. You know, the way that he lifted the trophy and everyone, you know, it was more important than the captain lifting it when you looked at it. And, you know, he's clearly done a great job, and he's probably gone in there before and said, right, I'm going to retire after this. It'd be great to lift the trophy. I'm going to get my kit on despite not being in the squad, and I'm going to get up there and be like the second or third person to do it. But he equally just says, I really enjoy watching the football now. Sometimes I just go and sit in the stands with a cup of tea and watch it with my little boy. And I think for him, he's probably just embraced the fact that he could get a last paycheck, he can watch some decent football. probably get one of the best seats in the house as well, and go and just work with some of these amazing professionals like Eden Hazard.
It says a lot that we've talked more about Rob Green on this podcast than Eden Hazard, who's going to Real Madrid. We've literally just given him more airtime. But, I mean, like you say, it's what dreams are made of. And talking of what dreams are made of, join us after this break for a little roundup of the Championship playoff final.
Get in there.
It promises to be another special Champions League evening, and here to enjoy it all with us are Rio Ferdinand, Steven Gerrard and Ian Wright. All three have had their hands on this trophy, Rio and Steven in Moscow and Istanbul respectively. And Ian, when he walked into the studio this evening... I've been looking forward to that all day.
You should have said when I walked into the studio and grabbed the back of your head.
great stuff.
Welcome back to part two of this week's Sweeper podcast. We're taking a trip to the Championship for the last time this season. We saw a promoted team go up through the playoffs.
We did indeed. And
it was bloody exciting, wasn't it?
Yeah, you said to me, I mean, obviously when Villa got through the semi-finals, I got in touch, didn't I, and said, right, are you going to the final? Because we obviously went last season. Yeah. We were there to see a relatively abject performance against Fulham at Wembley. And you said... initially, you were kind of unsure, and then you thought the closer it got, do you know what? I'm gonna watch it at home. And I said to you, didn't I? I said you guaranteed if you go, it'll go wrong,
yeah.
and you'll lose. But if you stay at home, you'll go up. And you did it in relative style. I know that there was a little bit of a nervous last sort of 5 minutes or so, but other than that, I think you were comfortable.
Yeah, I mean, off the back of the strong finish of the season and obviously defeating West Brom in the semi-finals, local rivals, it was kind of. It was, as you say, it was either set up for failure or set up for magnificent triumph. And I think, yeah, we were the better team for large parts of the game. We looked destined to win and just very comfortable, really. I think we came up against a Derby side who, unfortunately, seemed to be a little bit overawed by the occasion. I was surprised at that because I thought, given their exploits in the Cups this year, I thought they may have been a kind of Cup side. And we saw them in the semi-final as well. And they... just turned it on, you know. They realised that they had to go and win the game, and they did. And they didn't really click into gear until the kind of last 10 minutes in this one as well. And you know, were it not for Tyrone Mings going off or going down injured, I'm not sure they would have scored. We looked very, very solid at the back. Twan Zabi and Mings were incredible. And I think getting a goal just before the break as well probably made a huge difference. It was a good goal as well. I think it was huge. And then obviously when John McGinn puts us 2-0 up, at that point, how the game had flowed, I kind of thought we might batter them. And I've rarely felt like that as a Villa fan, to be honest, but I thought we could go on and win this 4-0.
Yeah, it was a very comfortable performance, like you say, and I think that the scoreline probably didn't do justice to the performance that Villa produced. A little bit similar to what we were saying about the Liverpool game, though. As a fan, you don't really care, do
no,
you? I think
not
that
at all.
The most important thing in that scenario is the result, and it just has such a huge bearing. You look at an individual cup competition like the Europa League and... or the Champions League, something like that. You've got two teams going into it who ultimately don't have a huge amount to lose. You could argue that Arsenal, because they didn't get into the Champions League, do, but they had as much chance of winning it as Chelsea did. And in this game, it's your whole season comes down to one game. And not only that, but you look from both teams' point of views, there's a few loan signings in both squads who you would imagine if you'd have spent another season in the Championship probably wouldn't have stuck around. I don't think that Tammy Abraham would want to do another season in the Championship. Tyrone Mings has showed how good he's been, and Twan Zabi has also shown the immense potential that he's got. So you look at those players and you would imagine that Villa next season in the Premier League would be a perfect opportunity for them to really push on with their careers, whereas the likes of Harry Wilson, Mason Mount, players who've gone to Derby to try and get experience under Frank Lampard, they will probably want to test themselves at the highest level. And it just shows the difference between having players from the top flight and how much of a difference that can make to your season. But realistically, what's your ideal for next season? Is it just about staying up, or do you look a little bit further than that, given the exploits of Wolves this season and other promoted sides that have done quite well of late?
I think initially it's staying up. I think it's going to take us a little bit of time to kind of solidify. We've lost a lot of players, just purely in numbers alone, you know, we don't have a lot of players. We've released 8 players. Obviously, the loan players have gone as well, so we're kind of very under strength at the moment. We do have a little bit of money to spend, and I think the project at the club, the money, the vision, the ownership that we've got at the moment as well is a positive. I think it should be people buying into a project. I do think we'll be looking for a certain type of player rather than just going for anyone we can get to fill the numbers. I mean, the difference will be in a month's time when we kind of really need to be signing players, because at the minute we've got 1 recognised centre-half, we've got about 1.5 goalkeepers,
right.
We've got 1.5 strikers, and as you say, you know, arguably our better performers, with the exception of McGinn and Grealish this season, were loan players. I think Mings is going to come back. I think he's kind of odds on to come back. Anwar El Ghazi is coming back as well. Courtney House is coming back. So, you know, from that perspective, that's great. I don't think Tuan Zeba is going to come back. And I don't personally think Abraham will come back either. So, you know, we need to sign a striker. We need to sign probably another centre-half as well. And that's just the start of it. So it's going to be a tough one. I think we've got the potential to not only stay up, but build on that, finish comfortably mid-table, just given, again, the size of the club. I think the manager is fantastic as well. He's been an absolute credit to the club since we've been promoted. I saw a great interview with him and Christian Perslow, who's done fantastic jobs at other clubs as well. And I think, you know, with them two at the helm, with the owners who are completely backing us all the way as well, we've got the potential to push on now and be very, very comfortably a Premier League club again.
I think what Villa have to be careful of is what will now be known as Fulham syndrome.
Yeah,
the fact that you'd argue Fulham had pretty much everything in place at the start of last season to push on. They had a huge amount of money. Things were going well off the pitch. Jukanovic had got teams promoted in the past and was playing a relatively exciting brand of football, and then they just went to pieces in the transfer window, and on paper they looked like they would absolutely storm it and probably finish very comfortably, and it just shows that by dismantling a team that's been together for so long, that's not really the way that you want to start a season.
The difference with that is that we kind of haven't really got a choice with that. Obviously, we've lost players. There are, you know, players like Glenn Whelan, Alan Hutton, Mila Jednak, they're not Premier League players anymore, so we've done the right thing in getting rid of them, but equally, just not having the numbers there. If we rock up as it is today, first game of the season, we're going to end up playing Jonathan Codger at centre half or something. So from that perspective, we have to go and sign individuals. But whereas Fulham didn't, Fulham could have just kept the same team, brought in 2 or 3 players. But
and that's the difference.
You're absolutely right. I think it may well take us a little bit of time to bed in. I don't think, come kind of the end of September, October, if we're in and around the relegation places, I don't think there'll be a huge panic. I think it will just be a kind of building block throughout. But aside from Villa, I think we have to talk about the other two promoted clubs, Norwich and Sheffield United. I think there's 3 different circumstances with the 3 clubs and the way they approach the Championship season, and equally the way they will have to approach the Premier League season. And I'm intrigued to get your views with both of those, and also Villa as well. What do you think for next season?
It's a funny one, really, because I think out of the 3 promoted sides, Villa will be the ones that I would imagine will finish higher, which is quite an interesting point when you look at the fact that the other two were streaks ahead, really, of the rest of the Championship. Leeds aside, who obviously faltered towards the end. I would absolutely love all 3 of these sides to stay in the Premier League, because I think that they're all there on merit for a start, but also I think that the fans deserve it, really. As a fan of a club who's spent a decent amount of time in the Championship over the last 10 years or so, getting back into the Premier League is brilliant to look forward to watching your team on Match of the Day instead of having to find Quest on whatever channel it is on Freeview to watch Colin Murray present highlights at God knows what time of the day. It just makes a huge difference, and I think a fan of a Premier League side just appreciates everything so much more, especially when you've spent time in those divisions. And Villa have been quite lucky in that they haven't made that drop down into League One, but obviously Sheffield United have been there, Norwich have been there, those fans have been through the mill a little bit, and I think that you deserve that day in the sun. And the only issue from my point of view is if you 3 stay up next season, there's a good chance that Southampton go down. So I think Villa will probably do the best out of those 3. I think Sheffield United will probably struggle. You look at that squad that they've got, and there are a couple of players who sides in the bottom half would probably like to take a look at, but overall you'd imagine that that squad's probably outdoing the potential that they've got, and yeah. and Chris Wilder's got that extra 20% out of them, so they may well be another side like Cardiff this season.
That'd be so difficult to play against.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think Norwich will be a bit of an unknown, really. I went to see them earlier in the season away at Preston, and they got absolutely humped 3-1, looked really, really bad, and then I don't think they lost another game between then and pretty much the end of the season. So they've got good players, but they are heavily reliant on Timu Pukki. We don't know how he's going to cope up against Premier League defences, and it will be an interesting summer for all three. But I think from a Championship point of view, it does seem like the cream is rising to the top now, and the bigger sides that you maybe expect to get out of that division are starting to do so. And that's where the likes of Leeds will be absolutely kicking themselves this season, because it was in their hands with very little time to go.
I mean, next year you've got Leeds, Derby and West Brom, who you would expect to be up there again. I mean, Bielsa staying with Leeds, which, I mean, the fact that he was still there at the end of the season was amazing for me. But, you know, you've got Cardiff, Fulham and Huddersfield going down there. I suspect Cardiff and Fulham will certainly be challenging. Huddersfield might take them a little bit of time to do it, but I think, you know, they'll be fairly comfortable in there. And then looking at the sides that missed out in the playoffs, Middlesbrough, Bristol City, even Stoke might turn up this season as well. You know, there's certainly half of the league that you could say should be in the playoffs. And I think, you know, that makes for another exciting season.
And it wouldn't surprise anyone to see a side who finished down in the lower half of the table this season be challenging again. And
or even the promoted sides from League One. It's not uncommon,
yeah.
Is it?
I mean, I think Norwich probably finished in a relatively perilous position last season. But the season before. And obviously Daniel Farke, there was talks of him leaving at the end of that season, and he ended up winning the league by an absolute country mile. And I think that's where sides in the Championship will always have this idea that they're in with a chance. And that's what makes it such an interesting division.
Absolutely. Well, that's all for domestic football this season. Join us after this short break, where we decide whether the Nations League was just a glorified Le Tournoi.
Should have gone to Specsavers, Charlie, because I tell you what, he's not offside. Well, he's absolutely bang in line, not offside.
Well, maybe you should go also then, Jeff, because you couldn't see driving home the other night, because you don't even wear your glasses in TV in case you get slagged off. So you just stick to Specsavers and I'll do the game.
Welcome back to the Sweeper podcast, and it's time to go international. It's time to go Dutch, English, Swiss and Portuguese, because there was a little tournament, wasn't there, Mitch, over the last week or so that took place over in Portugal. And we're not going to talk too much about what happened off the pitch, because I think we need to get to the core of whether this whole thing was a bit of a sham or whether we actually enjoyed it.
Yeah, I genuinely don't know how I feel about the Nations League still. Now, I'm not disappointed that we didn't win it. I'm still not really sure how happy I would have been if we did win it. I just don't know. I get it, and I get why it's important, and I felt that the host country were probably the ones that took it the most serious, and they're arguably the reason why they won it as well, but we'll talk about that afterwards. In terms of England, I think it was a good opportunity to go and win something, you know, regardless of what merit you put on winning that something that it is. I think is just there for momentum more than anything. I think actually, if you look at it on face value of a competitive game of football, the first one against the Netherlands, it was frustrating, because I think England are possibly a better side than they showed that night. That said, there were different circumstances for that. We've talked about gaps in the season. We've talked about the Champions League final, which meant that we didn't play three, maybe four of our best players. And I think from that perspective, it was disappointing when you see that Netherlands played two of their best players. One of them, who was imperious on the night, Virgil van Dijk. I think he marshalled the defence very, very well, as he has done with Liverpool all season. I think, again, it was one of those games where both sides were just relatively poor, and unfortunately Netherlands had the cutting edge. However, they were helped out by England's mistakes.
Well, that's it. And like you say, obviously, Netherlands triumphed 3-1 in that game. And England were their own worst enemies, because although I would argue that Netherlands were the better side on the night, I don't think that it was as clear a gap as some of the pundits made out. You and I discussed this on Saturday. And I think that a lot of praise went to them rather than people talking about the frailties that England
both,
really caused themselves.
Both sides were poor. One was poorer.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you look at the way that England played. There were times when we played, and I'm going to go back to the World Cup because that's arguably the best sort of tournament football that England have played for quite a while. We knew when to mix it up in the World Cup. We knew when to go long and when to play out of the back. And it was like England were very, very confused in this game against the Netherlands. And whether that's down to the fact that players like John Stones and Ross Barkley aren't playing week in, week out for their club sides, or whether it's just that they are partial to a mistake and a lapse in concentration, it's difficult to say. But one thing's for sure, that is the absolute base that they need to work from. They need to decide whether they are going to be a side who are going to try and play out from the back on every single occasion, regardless of the amount of pressing that the other side are doing, or whether they are willing to mix it up. And from my point of view, it would have been far better to go with the latter. We showed at times against Switzerland in the game yesterday that there is a good time for Jordan Pickford to go long, and there was a move where Harry Kane hit the bar yesterday where it was great football, even though there was a long ball involved. And I think that's where we have to remember that the style of football isn't always the most important thing, that actually the victory is the most important thing. And we probably showed that in the World Cup last year. We weren't scared to score goals from set pieces. We weren't scared to put people forward from the back when we had an opportunity going forward. And there were just times in this where it looked a little bit like England had lost their identity.
Yeah, I mean, the most frustrating thing for me was the excitement of the front three against the Netherlands. Sancho, Sterling, Rashford. So much pace and kind of... There's one way to kind of play with them to a certain extent. As soon as Harry Kane came on, and you know, I think Rashford was probably injured. I don't know whether anything's come out to confirm that, but as soon as he came on, it was just so frustrating just watching every ball just bounce straight back off him. And I think that's the worrying thing for me. It was so exciting to have the front three as they were, and then for Kane, who has been fantastic for England over the years and Tottenham Hotspur, he came on and the whole game completely passed him by and seemed to pass England by as well, and with the exception of the disallowed goal, which was a great move, played on the floor through the defence, we didn't do anything else. And I think that's the frustrating thing. And I think if you're looking longer term, there has to be question marks about how we kind of try and get all of those players in together.
Yeah, I mean, we're probably at a point with England, and we talked about this a little bit, didn't we, last year, that there are players who are coming possibly towards the end of their time with that national team. And at what point does Southgate say, right, we're in transition period now, I'm going to start bringing some of these younger players through? You've got people like Jack Grealish, Harry Winks, James Maddison, Joe Gomez, Trent Alexander-Arnold. Those two that I've mentioned there at the end, they've obviously played more of late. But I think we were crying out for a player like Harry Winks, and I've been one of his bigger critics in the past. He's never really looked like he belonged in an England shirt, but actually I think when you consider the fact that we just didn't have anyone to get their foot on the ball in midfield during that game, everyone was looking for that first time pass rather than actually I can have a touch here and I can look up and I can see where the space is. And especially with the likes of Sancho and Sterling, you don't have to play a first time ball into them. You can have a touch, because the amount of times that they will get into space gives you the opportunity to play that ball through to them or play it over the top. And I just think that England panicked a little bit in a game that they didn't need to, because there was no real pressure on it.
It's the frustration for me and the likes of Lingard and Ali. You know, they're the ones that are always looking for little flicks here and there around the corner, and quite often they just end up in dead ends. You know, for me, Lingard's just about a squad player. I don't think he's a starter.
About to sign a contract for £130,000 a week at Manchester United.
Absolute madness. I've likened him to Philip Coutinho in recent days when I've had this conversation, and he's a scorer of very good goals, and I think that kind of drags him through. He could have 10 games where he does absolutely nothing. He scores a worldie and everyone goes, Jesse Lingard's incredible. Dele Alli, for me, does very little unless he's scoring goals. He was scoring goals regularly for Spurs 2 or 3 years ago. Since then, I think he's gone massively off the boil. I don't think he offers a huge amount in terms of linking the play up. I don't think he does enough defensively to be a central midfielder as a, you know, in terms of a number eight. And I think there's better players to play in the kind of 10 role, or even just sitting in the middle of the park. And I think, you know, if you're looking at those two as your central midfield partnership with another, you know, Henderson, for instance, for me, that's not necessarily going to work. But at what point does Southgate have to say, be very, very frank and honest, that's not the right way that we want to play?
And I think you look at the game yesterday against Switzerland, obviously it was a 0-0 draw. England went on to win it on penalties. That's probably about as much as we should say about it, because the spectacle just didn't exist.
Great quality of penalties.
Yeah, which, when the pressure's off and realistically no one cares about a third place playoff, is absolutely fine. But even Jordan Pickford came out after the game and said, if that was a proper match, I wouldn't have taken one. So that just shows what the players thought of that. Yeah. And I think the fact that, I mean, nobody's going to remember that you finished in third place in the inaugural Nations League tournament, are they? And that's probably something that UEFA need to take a look at and think there's absolutely no need to have that game. And if I'm Gareth Southgate, I would say that now is a good time to be testing out these players that are coming through. We will absolutely walk the group for the Euros. There's no way that we're going to miss out on that. And if we did, we've still got the playoff to fall back on. And I think this is the opportunity for him to bring through some of these players that have been doing well for their club sides, albeit not so well for the under-21s. And there's been talk that Southgate will walk away after the Euros. And I personally think that would be a massive shame, because he's shown what he can do. And to get England through to consecutive semi-finals, regardless of the competition, is something that should be applauded. And there's no point being too hard on that England side, because ultimately it was individual errors that cost us in these games. But what we have to do now is we need to look to the future. And I think that's where we have to probably take stock and think about the careers of some of these players at an international level. At what point do we say enough's enough? And I think that's probably the most crucial point that England take away from what will be largely a frustrating summer. I don't know what your opinion is on that, or whether you want to just move straight on to the final. Or
no, I think, you know, we've, as you say, we've kind of got that opportunity now to test things out. And I think if you look at the squad, we probably do have very good squad depth, possibly the best squad depth that we've had for many, many years. But I think now he has to figure out what the system is. You know, we are playing a different system to what we played in the World Cup last year, and we have three or four players that could arguably be starting every single game for England that we didn't necessarily have then, or have as established. So, you know, if you just work through the side, Pickford is the number one, and probably rightly so. I think I agree with what was said on the commentary yesterday. He's arguably a better international keeper than he is a club keeper. Alexander-Arnold should in theory be England's right back for the next however many years. I think he offers us something that we haven't necessarily had in terms of the accuracy of his crossing. And I think with that in mind as well, you have to play a certain way to make the most of that. Again, you kind of look at Harry Kane in that. In theory, he should be thriving off that. If he's not, then potentially we have to look at the options there, because there's a one way to play football with Harry Kane, I think, or you possibly drop him deeper, which is what I would do. Drop him deeper. You've got Sancho and Sterling as the starting base to play in front of him. And I think that central midfield as well. We've got someone like James Maddison, who I'm still not sold on him 100%. I think he's had a good season. I think he's got potential to move forward, but give him a start. You know, give him a few starts, see what he can do. Alexander-Arnold, do the same. Build your team around these players who in theory could make the difference. That's not necessarily what we are doing at the moment. I think we're kind of patching it up with players that are on merit a little bit. And we've got the opportunity not to do that. And we've got a huge opportunity with the Euros next year, in the semi-finals and the final being at Wembley. You know, they should be playing towards those. We should be able to get there. There are nations that are good enough to challenge us for that. But we are one of the top, certainly, five nations in Europe. So why not do it?
Talking of the top nations in Europe, obviously Portugal-Netherlands played out another thrilling final. And Ronaldo is coming towards, you would imagine, the end of his Portugal career. Yeah. He's won, in his mind now, two major trophies with that country. And I think it's difficult to argue with his performance in the semi-final, which he pretty much won single-handedly. A little bit quieter yesterday, and I think it allowed the likes of Bernardo Silva, Bruno Fernandes to pull the strings. And obviously, the goal itself, I think you've put in your notes that the goalkeeper's got to do better.
Yeah, absolute limp wrists. I don't know why. It's a bit of an odd one, really, and I think he may have been put off by the fact that Ronaldo was stood on his own just waiting for the pass to come to him, but it was hardly a snapshot. It was just a bit of an odd one, but I think Portugal have a good squad, plenty of young players coming through as well, and I think Ronaldo coming to the end of his career with Portugal, possibly after the Euros, it's going to be interesting to see how they adapt to that. You know, it's similar to what we just said about England, there's probably a very limited way that you can play when you've got someone like that who is the focal point for the team. And I think, you know, with some of these individuals, they have got a lot of talent. We've just said Bernardo Silva and Bruno Fernandes. Bernardo Silva's been unreal this season in Manchester City. He should be one of the world's best footballers going forward. And Bruno Fernandes, as we've seen with Sporting Lisbon this season, just pulled the strings left, right and centre for them, and will get a move to a top club, no doubt. And I think, yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see what Portugal do, because they are, in theory, at the very top of the European game as the current European champions and now Nations League champions.
That's it. And that's it for us in terms
of... One second. How are we giving trophies out nowadays? It's an absolute joke. They get the trophy, then they have to walk over to their team.
It's a difficult one, because as English fans, or as English domestic fans, we're used to seeing trophy presentation at Wembley, which I think is personally done in the right way. I don't like this plinth thing where you have to, like you say, walk up and pick it out. Pick the trophy
it's
up.
It's just really
walk
awkward,
over.
Though, isn't it?
It is.
When you have a trophy in your hand, the initial instinct is just lift it up.
Yeah.
Do you know what it is? UEFA.
Let's just blame them for everything.
Fucking idiots.
And that's it for
so angry
international football, domestic football. The only thing that's left to do is to wrap up this season with one final quiz. Shut up and...
Welcome back to the final part of the final Sweeper podcast of the season. We are going to the quiz, and Michael Hole is just in dreamland at the moment. He's got this round to go. He's 32-28 up, just with a chance to stretch that out to a huge, huge lead before he lifts that trophy.
You've definitely reined me in a bit, though, because I think at one point I had something like an 11-point lead, and now it's down to four.
It is down to four.
I think I would like to try and stretch it out, but ultimately I've got to be professional about this, and it's all about the trophy.
I could have been a bit of a dick and just give you a really, really difficult one just so it finished with four. But I haven't.
Good to know.
I haven't. You might get five.
I might get five?
No, you might be five ahead.
Oh, right, okay.
Anyway, blockbusters.
Yeah.
Last blockbuster of the season. Why is for yellow cards? Which player had the most yellow cards in the Premier League this season?
Oof. Good question.
And this player got 14 yellow cards, which Blimey. Was two more than anyone else.
Whoa, that's tough. Who served quite a few bans this season? I'm struggling, Mitch. Who can I get 14 yellow cards? That's quite a lot, isn't it?
Yeah.
I'm going to go for Fernandinho.
Incorrect. It's Etienne Capoue.
Oh,
Capoue,
is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Just loves the yellow card. O is for offside. In Premier League history, since the stats were recorded, which former North London, North West based striker has been caught offside the most? 328 times, in fact.
North London and North West.
Yeah, to give you a bit of a clue, I think. No.
Still not an easy question, is it?
No.
I am going to go for Nicolas Anelka.
I thought you'd go there, and it's incorrect.
Ah, right.
It's Emmanuel Adebayor.
Is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Emmanuel Adebayor. And we're going A for Adebayor for the next question.
Okay.
Who do you score more goals for, Arsenal or Spurs? 50-50.
I'm going to go for Tottenham.
Is Arsenal. 46 for Arsenal, 35 for Spurs.
Finishing very, very strongly in this quiz so far.
Right, here's your chance.
Go on.
L is for Liverpool, the European champions. But 10 players have been transferred between them and Southampton since the turn of the 90s. Can you tell me 5 for 1 point, 6 for 2 points, 7 for 3, 8 for 4, or all 10 for 6 points? points. So, but you've got to call it out now.
But this could be either way.
Yep.
Right, okay. Just run me through the points again. I'm not thinking of who.
So, 5-1, 6-2, 7-3.
And does it have to be directly transferred between, or can it be...
So, there was one that was an emergency loan. So, they could go on free transfer, so I guess the end of their contract.
Right, okay. And it was 5-1?
5-1.
Right, well, in that case, I'm going to go for 6.
Okay, 6-2. If you get one wrong, it's game over.
Right, Ricky Lambert.
Correct.
Dejan Lovren.
Correct.
Adam Lallana.
Correct.
Virgil van Dijk.
Correct.
Sadio Mane.
Correct.
So how many is that?
That's 5. So you need one more.
Bollocks. Nathaniel Klein.
Correct. You'll kick yourself because you'll know a lot more.
Well,
so
I was
going to
say, I'll keep going.
Yeah.
The emergency loan, was it a goalkeeper?
Yeah. But that doesn't count.
Okay. Because I'm pretty sure Paul Jones went to Liverpool.
Correct. For a month.
Yeah.
In 2004.
Who else has made that ill-fated journey? I'm not sure they've given us anyone, have they?
Yes.
Have they really?
Yeah, you've got a current player.
Oh, that's quite embarrassing then. Go on.
Danny Ings.
Oh, right, okay, fine. Yeah, see, my thinking on Danny Ings was that he's not transferred yet. We had him on loan and
right. The
transfer isn't complete. I definitely didn't forget all about him. Go on, who else?
So you got Bruce Grobbelaar.
Okay, again, Mark, I didn't know if that was a direct one.
Mark Walters.
Yeah.
Peter Crouch.
Of course, yeah.
And there will have been... Is that all?
I think that's a lot. Yeah. I'll take my...
Two points.
I'll take my 2 points.
And then finally, just because it's the best competition in the world or the best game in the world, peace for playoffs. Can you tell me which team has been to and subsequently won the most Football League playoffs? Only one of them has resulted in a promotion to the Premier League.
Ooh, good question. So
that's obviously League 2, 1 and Championship players.
I'm trying to think of a yo-yo side, a team that have been up and down the leagues a few times.
I think all of them have been since the 90s as well,
right,
I think,
okay.
From memory, or most.
No, I was going to go for Norwich, but no. I'm going to go for... No, they've never been in the Premier League. This is really difficult. I'm going to go for Watford.
Incorrect. It's Blackpool.
Oh, yeah.
7 finals, 5 wins.
Because they've won the League 2, League 1 and Championship playoff finals, haven't they? I think they're one of the only sides to do it. So
I think there is one other team.
Who is it? I don't know who that is.
Huddersfield.
Right.
I believe.
I think we discussed this earlier in the season, so it just shows how great my memory is.
Potentially.
Really good questions, really poor answers.
So you've ended on 34, so you've won by 6 points this season. Well done.
It's comfortable without being an absolute rout.
Yes. Yeah, it's less embarrassing for me than it could have been.
And we've shared the trophies this season, because you're the Fantasy Premier League champion of not only the show, but the...
Pretty much everything.
The whole Sweeper Podcast League.
Yeah.
And you've just missed out on the double, but I think we'll both take a trophy.
You're the quiz master.
And you are the Fantasy Premier League master.
Indeed. Speaking of quizzes, we are definitely going to have a quiz, and I think it's going to be in September, because it's going to be around Freshers.
That's
again.
The plan. Yeah, it will no doubt be taking place at our usual haunt of Leeds, Beckett University, and we would absolutely love to see as many of you there as possible.
And I think on the quiz, we are changing things up a little bit next season. Life, work, travel, everything is kind of getting in the way, unfortunately. But we are going to put some more energy into both the live events and the podcast. And we're going to mix it up, aren't we?
We are, yeah. If you have got an interest in football, which I imagine you probably will do if you're listening to this show, then stay on board.
Yep.
And we're going to try and introduce another element into the show. It's not going to be all about that element. It's still going to be football-based. But we are hoping to do a little bit more around guest slots, aren't we? We're hoping to have a few more people on the pod with us next season. And we'll probably be going to a little bit less frequent episodes. However, the content will arguably be more interesting for those of you out there.
I would agree with that. I think there's going to be a little bit more long form in there. We might do a few specials as well.
Yeah.
I think we'll be looking for some participation in that as well. And yeah, I think if you've got any suggestions of things that you would want us to cover, talk about, people to talk to as well, I think it'd be really interesting. I think we're looking to branch out, grow the brand a little bit as well. I think we've got to be a little bit of a business in this. But I'm really looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to a break, for sure. I know we've had quite a lot of breaks ourselves over the last few weeks, but I think it's time for us to recharge the batteries.
That's it.
Get refreshed and get on the beach, as they say.
Absolutely right. I would like to say thank you to everyone who's listened to the pod this season. Thanks to those of you that have come down to the live events as well. We've had a great time at those. And happy football season 2019-2020. It's not too far away.
I would like to thank Dean Smith and Jack Grealish.
Up the Villa and up the Saints. Are we even going to cover the Championship next season?
Nah, fuck it.
You're out.
Yeah. See ya. Bye.
What is your favourite breakfast cereal? Well, back in the day, I used to promote a breakfast cereal called Sporties, so I would have said that. Don't really have cereal too much, but if I was going to go for one, I'd go for Crunchy Nut Corn Flakes. Have some of that.